First of all, let me congratulate the Socialist Party's speaker. I enjoyed his speech very much indeed. Once one said that, what actually worries me is this, that, I mean, though he speaks in terms of a strategy, and that strategy is revolution, it seems that the only way, to my mind, if you actually win people to socialism is actually within struggle itself. And in the process of doing that, you're under the actual dangers of reformism. I'll give you one typical example of reformism, and a lot of people laughed. The question of hypothermia, it's very true. A lot of Labour councillors, because of their hypothermia, actually kept the old people alive. Now, I mean, I know it's, in an emotional sense, reform is a very nasty word, and revolution is a nice word. But Marx also spoke about the question of quality of changes leading to quantity of changes. Within the continual struggle of socialism, it's possible to win quantitative changes, which may, if the struggle, if one is in the position to carry on the struggle, that can actually lead to qualitative changes itself. I mean, if one argues that you've got to win 51% of people to socialism, I mean, you're speaking in terms of a sudden jump from that qualitative change. The question is, what quantitative stages will the Socialist Party actually go through to actually win us to this position of socialism?
Yeah, thanks for your question. And let me try to clear up what I see as a misconception, which Lawrence Spiegel has presented about reformism. I think it's a quite genuine misconception. I think you've got to dismiss the idea that there is some sort of clear-cut distinction between the day-to-day struggle and the revolutionary struggle. There isn't. The revolutionary struggle arises, and it only can arise, out of the day-to-day struggle. You know, revolutionaries are not people who sit around in university philosophy seminars talking in abstractions about the movement from Hegel to Marx to various... This isn't what revolution... We don't argue that revolution arises out of that. Revolution does arise out of the class struggle. And the class struggle is inevitable under capitalism. But let me make this important point. There is a complete difference between workers trying to improve their position within capitalism, which we all do in the trade unions. And incidentally, let's not have any point scoring about this. I and my comrades in the Socialist Party are every bit as much, if not more, than some people in the Labour Party, engaged in a very clear and militant way in our trade unions to try to bring about improvements for workers. There is an important difference between that and between something which is different. And that is the reformist attitude of saying to a government, we call upon you to run capitalism on a local level or on a national level in our interest. That is what reformism does. Reformism hands over power to politicians and to governments and says, try to give us a better deal out of capitalism. Of course, in our trade unions, we can get a better deal out of capitalism. And when you talk about hypothermia, and incidentally, I regard it as being absurd, not to mention somewhat obscene, for anyone to argue that hypothermia, where people in their thousands die as a result of the fact that they can't afford to buy heat, the fact that that is happening 10 less in one Labour borough than in a Tory borough, and that's certainly never been proved in any of the statistics that I have seen, and I've studied them carefully, whether or not that is the case, it certainly doesn't make any difference whatsoever to the basic argument that capitalism is the cause of that problem. It's capitalism that creates it. And you see, what you have to do in relation to reformism is this. You have to recognise that what you go for when you are aiming for socialism is not simply something a little bit better. What you've got to go for is what is achievable. The question you ask in every single struggle is not what can we get accepting limitations, but the question you have to ask as a socialist is what can we get accepting the historical possibilities. And that strikes me as the classic distinction between reformism and revolution. The reformist goes in very sincerely and sometimes successfully within limitations and says, what can we squeeze out of capitalism? What the revolutionary is constantly doing is saying, not what can we squeeze out, But what lies beyond what immediately seems apparently to be possible, what lies beyond that, and what can we get in society? And in relation to the miners' strike, for example, rather than demanding the right to work, the right to be exploited, rather than demanding simply that workers are persistently put into a dirty and dangerous industry, what we need to be looking at is the possibility of running a society on the basis of getting rid of all of the misery and poverty which is built in to the lives of millions of workers who shouldn't be fighting simply to preserve their level of poverty. They must be fighting to abolish the poverty. And again, in relation to hypothermia, is it not a tragedy that in 1985, workers who are in their 60s and 70s and 80s are being called upon simply to have the right to have enough heat to stay alive, simply to have a can of beans to open every day to keep them alive? That's not enough. What we have to be putting before workers is the fact that every single old person in this country and in other countries is going to be in a position, because it is now technologically possible, to live not just an existence, but a life which is satisfactory. So I would say the difference between reformist struggle and revolutionary struggle is that the reformist doesn't simply try to get a better deal out of his or her trade union and on a political level reject capitalism. The reformist goes all of the way, leaving the power in the hands of the capitalist class and not recognising that beyond that power there are achievements which have not even been dreamed of by reformists up to now.
Can you honestly say that you believe this country is closer to socialism today than it was when the Labour Party had its first representative in Parliament? Because it's difficult for me to see that it is.
As I said, I don't see socialism in any sort of obvious, tangible, material sense that is immediately observable. But in important ways, in talking about the quality of housing, the fact of working fewer hours, the fact of the opportunities for a whole range of cultural and welfare resources have been won through class struggle, and lost through a struggle which has been limited and weak because of the weaknesses of its institutions, but in important ways those improvements have been won and are continuing to be secured against capitalism. There have been improvements in the society, and if we look on a world scale, and as socialists we must see things on a world scale, there have been important ways in which the struggle for socialism, the struggle against capitalism, have taken place on a world scale. And I think it would be important for us to recognise that the struggles that have taken place in this country have aided and abetted and have supported and helped those struggles in other countries. Of course, not enough has been done, but it's only by continuing to secure the return of a Labour government in this country that those struggles for liberation in other countries, those struggles against the transnational corporations which rule the world, the struggles against US imperialism, it is only by securing the return of a Labour government in this country committed to the sort of policies which have been imposed on the Labour Party in recent years, committed to the sort of vision which has opened up within the Labour Party within recent years, that we will continue to make any progress, not only in this country, because the problems in this country pale into insignificance when we consider the problems which oppress people in other lands, particularly in the Third World. They pale into insignificance. And the return of a Labour government in this country can in important material ways help those desperate struggles in Latin America, in Central America, in Africa, and in other countries. And that is why there has been improvements, and we must fight for the return of a Labour government to consolidate those improvements.
I'm a visitor today, and I realise that the essence of debate is debate, but there is one point that I am a bit confused of, and that was the feminist disagreement between something that appears to me to be a countable fact, and that was the number of people in this city and this country that have died of hypothermia. And I would just like to ask both speakers, where they got their information and how many it actually was.
I could answer that readily. I've been doing a lot of reading about that just lately. And I can tell you now, the fact of the matter is that if you look at the most important report on hypothermia that was ever carried out, which is a report called the Fox-Wicks Report, which has been clearly reported in the British Medical Journal, the Fox-Wicks Report showed that tens of thousands of people every winter in Britain die as a result of the cold. They die as a result of the cold because they cannot afford to buy heat. And let me simply say to you that every winter in Britain there are 40,000 more people over the age of 65 who die than during the summer. And I think that it would not take very much research, although a great deal of research has gone into it, to understand that the reason that thousands of old people die every winter of the cold, who don't die in the summer, is because of the fact that they can't afford to buy electricity, they can't afford to buy coal. And we see this time and time again. My opponent is a social worker, and he must have gone around to the homes of old people who've had electricity cut off, who can't afford coal, who have to make the choice between spending money that they have from the social security on buying enough food to eat or on lighting a fire. And finally, as a piece of evidence, I will say this to you. The British government, and by this I mean both the present Conservative government and the last Labour government, has perpetuated over a period of years a tremendous fraud in terms of statistics, where it has argued, and if you look at the statistics from the Office of Censuses, you will discover that according to the British government, only a matter of hundreds of people, indeed according to the figures for last year, less than 100 people, died of the cold in Britain. That is a matter of absolute fraudulence, and I am absolutely surprised to see a member of the Labour Party defending that kind of statistic. The British Medical Journal and most of the research that has gone in, including that from a Professor Collins at University College London, which was reported in the Sunday Times 2 weeks ago, argues that tens of thousands of people die every year in Britain from the cold because they can't afford not to do so. That's a fact.
Well, if I could say, the terms of the argument have slightly shifted. I mean, the question of people dying in winter because old people who are more frail are more vulnerable to the cold is not to immediately suggest they're dying of hypothermia, which is a particular condition caused by malnourishment and a peculiar condition into which people go because of a lack of heat but also of proper nutrition. And one cannot correlate the statistics on the evidence of people dying in winter. And we should remember that there is a code of practice secured by struggle, secured through the struggles of pensioners and the welfare rights struggles, and introduced by the last Labour government, that means that the fuel supply of pensioners cannot be cut off in winter. And it is in Labour councils during winter periods that they are able to achieve, if disconnections do take place or people are at risk, because we are in touch through a whole range of services with vulnerable and frail elderly people, we can ensure that they do not fall into the syndrome of hypothermia.
Look at the figures for Islington. They exist.
It is just not true to say that tens of thousands of people in this country, I'm making no argument that old people are not forced into impoverished standards of living. We have the lowest pensions in Western Europe. We are denied a whole range of services which are available and should be available and would be available, of course, in a social society. But at this point of time, it is not accurate to suggest there is a correlation between the incidence of death due to cold in the winter and the incidence of hypothermia. They are not directly correlable.
Next question, please. Right, yours.
I'm interested by the question of the covert aims of the Labour Party and what they do and what they say they do. On the one hand, we have evidence presented that socialist government, socialist representatives are very willing to act against the interests of the workers by chucking them out of houses, or similarly by education authorities, local education authorities, so-called socialist ones, deciding to act against the interests of the teachers in their pay by docking their pay for refusal to cooperate with various lines. On the one hand, you have this blatantly anti-socialist behaviour, but on the other hand, you have material progress in the form of, over the last 300 years, there have been liberalisations in the structures here where you can get more money, you can get a certain amount more freedom, more comfort than you're able to in the Dark Ages. You know, it's a pretty dark comparison, but things are still a bit better than going around with a thatched roof and mud in your courtyard. But even given that the Socialist, the Labour Party, stands to try and improve material conditions, and that from time to time things have got a little better, what would the speakers say to the suggestion that the only difference between the Tory party and the Labour Party is that the Tories want workers to be maintained in conditions of servitude irrespective of their material comforts. The Socialists, the Labour Party, would like servitude maintained merely at a greater level of material comfort.
There are just two points to be made to that. Does a Labour Council, does the Labour Party, the Labour representatives abandon the struggle for material improvement to cast people back into virtual slavery, to give up the political advances that have been made? Do we abandon that struggle because it is difficult? And it is difficult running a Labour Council. Of course Labour Councils have made people redundant, have imposed cuts in services. Of course they have, because they have a difficult job managing local councils against not only the problems of central government, against the attacks from sectarians who would try and undermine Labour councils because they want to deface the credibility of Labour councils. And we're talking in an area where the local council is not immune from such sectarian attacks itself, which have just one purpose, and I can think of particular groups who have no other purpose but to undermine the credibility of Labour councils. And because the issues are difficult, because the struggles to secure and maintain services are difficult, do we give up that struggle because it isn't easy, because you have to cope with difficult budgets, because you're faced with lessening of your rate base as you are in the East London boroughs and your loss of your block grant from Whitehall? If the answers were easy, they could immediately pay everyone similar wages, £10,000 a year, as has been demanded by various groups. Of course it would be done. It is not possible. If there was massive mobilisations which demanded those changes overnight, of course that transformation could take place much more quickly. But we have the small problematic fact of a Tory government voted in. We have the small fact of Labour councils being thrown out, replaced by Conservative councils. We have various other problems about trade union movements who have very limited visions, very limited aims, and do engage in guerrilla warfare against Labour councils in a way which they never engage against Conservative councils. So Labour councils always get attacked, have a much more difficult position than any other council. Also Labour governments have a much more difficult position. So I think we have to recognise we cannot abandon this struggle, we cannot ignore the struggle for material improvement because it's been regarded as invalid and worthless, and we have to deal with the difficult problems it throws up. And if that means you have to cut budgets occasionally, of course it's unacceptable, but it's something that on occasion there is no alternative.
Socialist Speaker, but briefly, please.
I will. First of all, I think that it's wrong to say, and no names were mentioned, so we don't know who we're talking about, but I think it's wrong to say that people exist simply to undermine the credibility of Labour councils. The fact of the matter is, in Islington, the Labour Council is perfectly successful at undermining its credibility without the help of anyone outside. Because most of the workers in Islington, I've read the Tory press, and it's very hard to read much else. But I'll tell you this: when you come to look at what's happened, we've got nursery workers here in Islington. They've been out on a ferocious on a strike against a ferocious council, and they don't care whether it's a Labour council or a Tory council. They're not out to undermine the credibility of the Labour council. They're out to try to struggle for their own interests. And they did that. And some of our members were at the nursery workers' demonstration in Islington. And one of the leading members of the Islington Labour Council walked up the town hall steps, and one of the women who was standing there was physically shoved out the way. And he said, "What are you doing in the way to the town hall? This is where we belong. We're here and we're doing our best for you." So they're undermining our credibility. And you only have to talk to workers about this. My opponent says that millions of workers... Does he know that more people resigned in disillusion from his party last year than have ever bloody joined our party? So the fact of the matter is...
It's not bloody difficult, is it?
Well, that might be the motion for next week's debate. But the thing is this... The thing
if
is this...
I had 10 people joined...
Well, I mean, that's a facile argument, I think.
That's pretty valid.
If you think that only 10 people have ever joined the Socialist Party of Great Britain, I think we've made a pretty remarkable impact for the 10 of us. We certainly seem to have upset you. But the thing is this, that when it comes to what workers are doing, in the 1983 general election, the Labour Party, do they not know it? They have the lowest share of the poll since 1918. And the reason for that is that workers, in their thousands, and incidentally the most politically aware workers, are simply saying they're not prepared to accept the Labour Party anymore. It's not happening fast enough, but it's happening. And that's why trade unionists this year who are in the Labour Party are having to fight a tremendous struggle to try to get trade union members to pay money into the Labour Party. Because trade unionists in my union and many others, they're simply saying, we're not prepared to pay for the party which, when in power, sends ministers to walk through Newquay picket lines, sends ministers to break the Grunwick strike with the special patrol group that it set up, sends ministers to break up the firemen strike when it sent in the army to cover for the firemen. That's what the Labour government has done, and that's the credibility of reformism. And there's one other point that I want to make. I think that what our friend there says is absolutely right, that what the Labour Party is in existence to do is to make the servitude of the working class more efficient, because I think the Labour government have got a lot to teach the Tory government. And in fact, the wets in the Tory party are learning very fast. And that is, of course, you don't exploit the working class by doing what Margaret Thatcher does and coming out quite openly and kicking them up the arse. What you do is you send in someone like Neil Kinnock. You make your Tracy Ullman video, you get him on television, you put on a nice piece of idealistic music like John Lennon's Imagine, then you get in, then you kick him up the arse. That's what they're doing.
You're going soon, over there, with a white shirt.
What about the glasses?
Earlier, you mentioned that the Labour Party would help the worldwide struggle for socialism. And through the Labour Party, we could probably help the third world. How do you equate that with times consistently that the Labour Party has sold us? There's no actual Labour Party. They've been involved in selling of arms. Has never stopped any company selling arms. They've been quite prepared to use troops in Malaya or anywhere else where it seems fit to defend its capitalist interests. Don't tell me that was the Labour Party 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. Because if they were wrong, tell me now, how are you not going to be wrong this time? How is that the future Labour Party going to be wrong again?
And they supported the pulpit war as well.
I said earlier that I'm not here to apologise for the Labour Party. And it does no good to all those comrades who have come into the Labour Party, to all those who look to the Labour Party, particularly in recent years, who would have no truck. And many of us demonstrated in Hyde Park during the Malvinas War against the Labour Party support for that war. And it's just my view that the strength of those currents, the strength of those shifts that have taken place within the Labour Party would make repetition of those jingoistic policies impossible.
Yes,
it would also...
They are not necessary policies for the Labour Party.
And I think the shifts that are taking place within the Labour Party, which would demand that the next Labour government demonstrate solidarity in a tangible way with the emancipation movement in South Africa, demonstrates its solidarity with the liberation movements in Central America, demonstrates its solidarity right across the world with liberation movements, controls the transnational corporations, to ensure that they don't work against the interests in any way at all, as far as is possible to control them from this country against those liberation struggles. That is what is possible, and it is very possible at this state of time. If we are to go down the other road, which is to tell people to abandon the Labour Party, to continue to undermine it, to suggest the Labour Party offers no hope, the only solution then is the return of a third term of a Conservative government, the pushing back into history of the possibility of establishing in tangible ways our solidarity with all those struggles. And I just do believe that there are very many people who have come into the Labour Party, who are looking to the Labour Party now, and particularly from the women's movement, who will insist that the next Labour government does not act in ways that previous Labour governments have. And I have confidence in those struggles. You may hear it 5, you may hear it 100 times, but just remember this, that at the end of the day, the bottom line still is, and it's been said to me, and I balk at the idea, but the bottom line still is, that the worst of Neil Kinnock is still better than the best of Thatcher. And that is a truth which we have to remember. And the return of a Labour government in which those who are committed to expressing their solidarity in all those ways, not only in this country with the movement of black people, the movement of women for emancipation from capitalism, will be advanced. To discredit the Labour Party, to argue against it, only leads into despair and brutalism, because Marx said there were two alternative routes, towards socialism or brutalism. And the only other road that is available to us, if we continue to discredit the only one party which offers, because it still commands the respect of many thousands and millions of ordinary people in this country, is the Labour Party. And it's not some imaginary respect that they have. There is some still concern, there is some still positive image, a powerful positive image, that the Labour Party does offer, with all its faults, with all its limitations, some hope across a whole range of fronts. And if only the Labour Party has the guts to mobilise those possibilities, and that can do that by committing itself strongly to those progressive policies, there will be a flowering of support for those radical policies, which will ensure there is no repetition of what we saw in 1982 in the Malvinas.
I see a great flood of hands still. You're next, and then you after that.
Mr Chairman, the title of the debate is What is Socialism? That it goes on to talk about something else. Now, the SPGB speaker gave a very concise idea of what he meant by socialism. Now, Mr Spiegel, during the course of his remark, mentioned socialism, working towards socialism, and so on, several times. And I want to know, Mr Spiegel, what you mean when you said socialism, that you're working towards it, and this is going towards it, and that is going towards it. What did you actually mean when you said that word socialism? Now, you may not have the whole of it, but even tell me 10%.
In a very simple way, it means rather than being prisoners of an economic system and prisoners to its own imperatives and its laws of motions, we control the productive resources of this planet. That is what socialism means to me, and that is what we are trying to achieve through our political struggle. And we will only achieve it through that political struggle.
With the atom bomb.
Yes. Mr. Spiegel, I'd like to ask you how on earth we're supposed to support the Labour Party when, whenever it did get into power, it adopted the policies of conventional capitalist politicians to keep it's a ration of the workers' share of the economy, and furthermore, it still has a policy to stay in NATO, which is a big imperialist racket, which supports the arms trade. It also supports the conventional, so-called conventional arms trade. How on earth can you say that's socialist when it supports aims which are concerned with fighting other human beings in the rest of the world? And it's done so many things. When it was in power last time, it lost power because it was fighting the miners in precisely the same way that the Tory government fought them. Because it wouldn't give them a fair deal, because it still had the same miserly policies that the Tories have towards ordinary people.
simply within that movement, within that party that does continue to command the respect and loyalty of millions of people in this country, and they look to that party for social advance, for socialism. There are very strong and powerful currents which are demanding radical policies and which will demand the imposition of those radical policies. Withdrawal from NATO, abandonment of all arms policies, controls of the transnational corporations. But that party, unfortunately, and you may like it, you may not like it, still does command the respect of millions of people, and within it there is a growing confidence of that movement will ensure the imposition of radical policies through the next government.
But it hasn't. It's still going on the same old way.
Right. Now, somebody well at the back. Right, that I can see a hand and not a face. That's the one. It's far enough back.
Rick, speaker from the Socialist Party. So when you spoke an awful lot about what socialism... you spoke more about anti-capitalism and anti-everything, but you didn't really say how it's going to be sort of after the revolution. And given I accept that we're still going to have factories that make videos and washing machines and things like that, and so there's people who are going to do mundane jobs on assembly lines, aren't they going to suffer from their work experience, which is going to be a subjective poverty? They're still going to suffer from that, no matter who owns it, someone's going to do mundane jobs.
Yeah. Well, I say two things. First of all, you're right that what I was doing most of my time, and what I think socialists have got to do most of the time, is attack capitalism. And the reason we've got to do that is because socialism comes out of an understanding of what capitalism is. If you don't understand what capitalism is, you end up trying to run it from the point of view of the workers, and that's fatal. However, I think you're quite right. Socialism is not going to be a utopia. I think you've got to make this clear time and time again. Socialism is not going to be a utopia where there will be no people under pressure of hard work. It's not going to be a utopia where people are not going to become ill. It's not going to be a utopia where people are not going to be lonely. It's not going to be a utopia where human rationality is going to get things right every time, because democratic decisions are going to get things wrong on some occasions. What we can say about socialism is that it'll be a society where there are no longer property relationships dominating the way we live. It'll be a society not based upon private property as in the West, or upon state property as in the East, but it'll be based upon the common ownership of wealth by everyone. We can say, therefore, that it will be a society where the sole purpose of production will be to satisfy human needs. In other words, every time we look at a coal mine, we ask ourselves one question: do people need coal? And if so, we've got to run that industry. Because there is a fundamental difference between market demand, which is what capitalism recognises, and human demand, which is what socialists recognise. And therefore, in a socialist society, production will be solely for use. And furthermore, a socialist society will have to be a society organised upon the basis of free access to wealth. For the very simple reason that if you own everything in society, as a member of society, then you must have access to whatever society produces. Every person will have access to a house or a flat, because if that's what can be produced, if that's what's available, then resources will be put to that end. Every person in a socialist society will have enough food to be able to keep themselves alive and to eat, well, I would say, on the basis of the potential abundance of wealth that we can produce. In a socialist society, people will have free access to sources of energy. They'll have free access to entertainment that exists in society. We won't have one culture for the rich and then the Dallas and McDonald's hamburger culture for the people who produce the wealth. In a socialist society, people will work on the basis, I would argue, of voluntary cooperation and not the coercion of wages and salaries. In other words, socialism, in the words of Marx, will entail the abolition of the wages system. And instead of wage labour, we can talk about a society in which people contribute according to their abilities and take according to their needs. And a socialist society, above all, will be a society in which not only the more crude material wealth of the world, but the cultural facilities, which my opponent has very correctly drawn attention to, they too will be available to every person in society. In other words, in a socialist society, and call me simplistic for suggesting this if you like, no child will ever be born destined to have to live in poverty, destined to die of starvation, destined to have to get the kind of job that no one wants. So of course there will be problems, but on the basis of common ownership, democratic control, production solely for use, and free access to all wealth, that is a definition of socialism. And I notice one or two members of the Labour Party shaking their heads in cynical disbelief, but then again, one doesn't expect them to stand for that kind of aim.
Did you say the same thing? Yeah.
Well,
you're next. Yes. Could you speak up, please?
What do you foresee the role of violence being in the creation of a socialist society, worldwide socialist society?
Right. I'll first of all ask Stephen to deal with it. You'll also be welcome to have a conversation.
Eddie, what was the question?
The question you're asking is, what is the role of violence in the creation of a world socialist society? Is that right? Yes. I think there's a simple role for violence in the creation of a world socialist society. We, the workers, don't need to use any. And the capitalists, I think, are going to talk about using it. But there's one problem that the capitalists have got. And that is that they've only ever actually fought wars by getting workers to fight them for them. I mean, they never actually go out and fight their own battles. They're quite good at issuing orders. They're not very good at fighting. So a socialist society can be brought about democratically, and I would argue could be brought about peacefully, as the Chartists said and as the socialist movement has repeated. It will be peacefully if we can and forcefully if we must. But I must say that whereas Tories very often are not the people you find talking about class war. The reason that you don't hear Tories talking about class war, it's often said, is because they're too busy bloody fighting it. And the fact of the matter is that many of these people who have interests to defend are possibly going to try to put out some kind of struggle, maybe a violent one, against the majority of socialists. But let's face it, when you've got a majority of conscious workers who understand and want socialism, who are organised, who know what they're doing, who haven't got leaders who can be bought off, I would suggest that the Duke of Edinburgh and one or two of these other aristocratic twits coming out of the public schools and the Federation of Conservative Students won't take an army to defeat them. They take a regiment from Islington Branch, about 10 of us in fact.
I would like to try and get both parties back to what they still on paper stand for. In the case of the Labour Party speaker, now I noticed that most of the evening you were insisting that you had no idea at all really what socialism was, but you had no blueprint until you were actually challenged, and then you gave an answer that probably wasn't too bad as they go. But I'd like to ask you, what's wrong with the vote for? It's still on your party card. At least last one I saw it was. You haven't mentioned that. I'd like to know, do you do still stand by clause 4?
Yeah.
If not, why not? And if you do, in particular, the SPGB, Peter, what I'd ask you now is, you are taking the very account of how socialists have the working class can and should be won for such as ideas. When you ask about violence, you gave a very good but rather evasive answer, because does not the SPGB Technical Principles still say that what the workers will do when they understand is vote socialist in the parliament?
Well, on a point of economics, I have no quarrel at all with clause 4. I have no quarrel with what I understand of Marxist economics. The difference is, and the problem is, and what is difficult, obviously, for many people to accept, is the difficulties involved in creating the massive mobilizations of millions of working people to achieve control of society, to achieve the destruction of the state. And it's difficult if one thinks perhaps of the dismissive, sneering way in which the Labour Party is rejected, and one also sees evidence of perhaps of the same attitude in relation to organised religion. But what would you say if you were living in South Africa and you looked at the role that Bishop Desmond Tutu is playing in helping to mobilise, as only one person, but in a wide struggle against the apartheid regime? Would you reject what he is doing because he is labouring under the illusion, the fantasy of religion? Or would you try and join and build in his struggle, extend its boundaries, so the struggle against apartheid can finally overwhelm the apartheid regime? It seems that that difficulty of engaging yourselves in that struggle, winning those massive majorities, accepting what a very difficult business it is, seeing how revolutionary movements and dramatic challenges which have been made in various countries of the world, one thinks of Iran, one thinks of Chile, one thinks of Nicaragua, seeing the difficulties which they face and faced in organising the socialist transformation of society, it can only be won, that battle, by winning people into that struggle, by not dismissing that struggle. And it's a very, very difficult job. The return to fundamentalism, which is sweeping parts of the world, we see it in our own society with the elevated status now that is given to the church, and it was a strange way which the church took the moral leadership in the battle against the government from the miners, because the Labour Party to some extent abandoned its role. But the question of winning those massive majorities is difficult, and we heard this question about the Labour councils. Of course, it's easier not to take any part at all in those struggles, to say that Marx was right, the Clause 4 is right, and we'll just wait until it happens. It will not happen, and occasionally you have to dirty your hands. I do that every day, and I would suggest that other people do it as well.
You haven't answered the question, what about Clause 4?
I said I have no quarrel with it.
Could you explain Clause 4?
Your contribution. Yes.
Okay, it strikes me that one of the things that happens in the last few years is that the great majority of working class people at the last election didn't even vote for the Labour Party. They voted either for the SPD, SDP, Liberals, the Tories. And I don't think they actually did that because they found those parties lacking in the correct socialist perspective. Or in actual achievements on behalf of working class people. It seems to me that no matter how many, you know, that actually is the major problem, that no matter how many meetings we have of this kind, no matter how many erudite discussions, no matter how worthy those discussions are, there isn't a single person who voted Tory, who voted SDP, at the last general election, is going to come into any one of these, is going to change their mind, is going to vote Labour, or even better, you know, is going to actually join the SPGB as a result of what they've heard here.
So don't start them.
There just might, quite possibly, be one or two people who change their mind.
Ten.
As a result of the sort of work that the Labour Party does on the doorstep in between elections. But that's peripheral. I mean, the whole framework of this discussion has been around the idea of putting up the Labour Party. And when we talk of the Labour Party, we meant Labour, every Labour government, every Labour council, as a sort of straw man. And looking at every single failing of every Labour government, every Labour council, and knocking it down. And that's pretty easy, isn't it? It's pretty much the easiest task in the world. Well, let's just put the boot on the other foot, just for a moment. Say Ken Livingstone was here. Say David Blunkett was here. Say even that the leader of the local council, Margaret Hodge, was here. And we asked them, what have you actually achieved on behalf of the people that you represent in the few years that you've been in power? And they would have been able to think of people who've been in jobs who otherwise would not have been in jobs if it hadn't been for the decisions they've taken, of people who've been housed who otherwise would not have been housed, who've been living in slums if it hadn't been for the decisions they've taken, and of ethnic minorities, sexual minorities,
who've been given opportunities that they would not have been given if those Labour councils had not been in power. Okay, and we could all have ridiculed those decisions, derided them. They're pretty small fry, you know, in comparison to the grand overall project of the overthrow of capitalism and the creation of socialism. But say we get an SPGB speaker standing up here. We ask him, what in your entire life in politics have you ever achieved for one single working class person? What have you ever done to improve life for working people in the area you represent? What sort of answer are they going to give? Let's hear an answer.
Okay, let me answer. First of all, you say if you had Ken Livingstone here and you ask Ken Livingstone, what have you achieved out of your years in politics? Ken Livingstone would answer you in two words, Brent East. That's what Ken Livingstone's achieved.
Cheap trick.
It's a fact. It's a fact. It was a cheap trick on the working class of Brent East. You just hang on. I'm going to answer the question. That's a bit you're going to like even less. I've just started. And let me say something else. You know, when our friend here from the Labour Party says, you know, you're not going to change people's minds, you know, you want to learn something or two from the miners' strike that he was talking about, because you're the one who's defeatist. And this is what we always get from the Labour Party, this sort of defeatist talk. You can't change people's minds. You've got to work within the limits. You've got to do what's possible now. The fact of the matter is that there are moments in history where you have to challenge what appears to be impossible. You have to get up and show some solidarity and some strength to overcome what is apparently necessary. You've got to stop facing reality. The Labour Party has been facing reality for so long. It's buried 6 foot deep in bloody reality. And what we need to do is actually challenge that. So don't be so defeatist. We can, of course, win people to the cause of socialism in exactly the same way as the blokes in Nottingham, who are in a minority. They did win people over. It's the oldest argument in the history of the working class. You form picket lines. Why? Not, as Neil Kinnock would put it, in accordance with the morality of the opinion poll. Picket lines aren't there in order to beat people up. They're there to persuade people. And socialist meetings aren't here so that we can have academic discussions. They're to persuade people, and we need them in every trade union branch. But when you ask, what have I done for the working class, I give you two answers. One is, I'm not in the business of doing things for the working class. I'm not in the business of doing things for the working class. I'll say that. You can applaud if you like, because people are in the business of doing things for the working class. Make the admission that the change isn't going to come from the working class itself. But if you ask me, what have I done in the course of the class struggle? Well, I don't know what trade union you're in, but I'm a secretary of my trade union. I don't know how many collections you took up, not only during the British miners' strike, but last year there was a miners' strike in South Africa. The gold miners' strike, we took up the collections when Solidarity was formed in Poland, in a so-called socialist country, because the government there is a bit vague about defining socialism as well. We took up collections for Solidarity. So I would say this to you. Don't come along with your pessimistic and defeatist attitudes and moralise or preach to socialists about how we should be active, because I can tell you, if you want to put down on paper a list of what you've done in the course of the class struggle, and if I or any of my comrades put down what we've done, I can tell you now, you'll have a blanker sheet than we will.
No, you can't.
No, that's not true.
No, you can't.
Oh, yes.
No, you can't.
Yours, as I said, was going to have to be the last contribution before the summing up of the speakers.
Thank you, Mike. Can I ask if the meeting could take note, firstly, that the miners' struggle was in defence of a plan for coal, which the last Labour government negotiated freely with the miners. I think that should be borne in mind when the Labour Party gets rubbish, but I think people are really talking about Labour government being rubbish. They keep saying Labour Party, they have got a bit of a mixture, not very clear thinking in future terms. It was actually Labour government, supported by the Labour Party, which negotiated the plan for coal, and it's on the basis of that that the historic struggle took place. But I haven't been to an SPGB meeting before, so I've been very interested in the rubbishing that's gone on of the Labour Party, and I presume the Labour government. My only experience of the SPGB is one of your leading members, who is a member of the MCC, has been consistently supporting South African cricket tours. Now, I don't know how that achieves socialism. I don't know how that achieves socialism, but I'd be delighted to know, bringing up, finally, Chair, the question asked right at the beginning, how since 1906 has the SPGB been achieving socialism?
Do you want me to answer? Well, first of all, let's get away from the slanders here. First of all, there are no leading members of the Socialist Party. You might say that that's a reason the Socialist Party hasn't achieved socialism, if you have a leadership-based mentality. But I can tell you now, we don't have leading members, and as far as I'm concerned, any member of the Socialist Party who engaged in a reform campaign in favour of South African apartheid would simply be expelled from the Socialist Party. That's a fact. What we can say, of course, is that the Labour government, when in office, has sold arms not only to fascist dictatorships like Argentina, but to all kinds of other ones, and I think that is something which is much more important to talk about. But when you ask, what have we done since 1904 when we were formed? I'll tell you what we've done. What we have done as a socialist party is we have won over workers, a very few, small number of workers, to stand for a set of principles which they know are not in favour of capitalism, because you can only take two choices. You either are going to compromise, or alternatively you stick to socialist principles. And what we've done, and I'm not proud about it, is we haven't achieved socialism, we haven't got a mass party, we haven't got the respect of millions of workers, we haven't even got the illusion that we've got the respect of a million workers. but what we've got very clearly the knowledge that we haven't done what my opponent boasts about doing. We haven't got our hands dirty with the blood of workers in Vietnam. We haven't got our blood dirty with the workers in Korea. We've never supported a war. We've never supported racist immigration legislation. We've never supported a single action which is against the interests of fellow members of our class. That's the position we've taken. And I only wish, and you don't seem to, but I only wish that I could say to you that what we've done in the years of our existence is not only failed to make the mistakes of the Labour Party, but succeeded in achieving socialism. I wish we'd done that, but we haven't. And I think it's up to you to decide whether or not we do achieve socialism.
I'll now ask Lawrence Spiegel to sum up the meeting as a whole from his point of view.
I said I wasn't here as an official spokesperson for the Labour Party, and I was not going to be an apologist for the Labour Party, but I will say this and ask you to consider it most seriously, that within the Labour Party there are powerful currents, there are powerful positive forces which are ensuring that the Labour Party itself is transforming itself, that the labour and trade union movement on a wider scale is also being transformed, is responding to a different, more expanded agenda, which is taking up those hidden struggles, which is confronting the violence, not the question of revolutionary violence, that is always something that's thrown in, the violence which oppresses and impoverishes people today in their daily lives. The Labour Party is responding to those issues in a new way and with new confidence. But if it is to be continually attacked by those who are not sympathetic to it, if it is to be continually convulsed by those who will stand in the way both inside the party to any progress, but also in the progressive movements around the Labour Party who will continue to attack it, who will continue to try and undermine it, those struggles which are now being put on the agenda for the democratisation of society, the struggles for women's rights, the struggles for liberation, the struggles against racism and sexism will be put aside again and will be lost. And it is important that we help and support and nourish those positive movements which are taking place within the Labour Party, which are winning over thousands of people to join it. Of course people are leaving, but more committed comrades, more progressive comrades are coming in. And I was told by my friend sitting next to me that they were wrong. No one in the Labour Party, least of all myself, has any illusions that I can say to someone else that they are wrong. And particularly when I meet many of these people who are coming into the Labour Party and I note their sincerity, I note their interest, I think they have it right. They say the Labour Party is a progressive party, it is changing, not only in this country, in other countries, the so-called reformist countries are responding to issues which for too long have been hidden. They are taking up those challenges, and through a next Labour government, and we must have another Labour government at the next election, the Labour Party itself, which is being transformed, can only help to ensure that those issues are dealt with if all those on the left help and support and nourish and don't criticise and don't attack and don't undermine and rake up things which are, they happened but should not be held up every time to tell people they should not support the Labour Party. Because what you will be doing then, of course you'll be helping to elect another Tory government, you are helping to ensure that unemployment continues, you will be helping to ensure that no solidarity can be expressed with those other liberation movements which are much more desperately in need of our help than anyone is in this country. Thank you.
Well, first of all, Mr Chairman, I would like to congratulate my opponent from the Labour Party for being democratic enough to put forward the views of the Labour Party. We were told earlier that if only Margaret Hodge was here, we could have a debate with her. The trouble is, the Socialist Party in Islington, which is very well known to the local Labour Party, I might say, we've been trying to get Margaret Hodge out of the town hall for the last 5 years. And the only time she's prepared to come out of the town hall is when she goes to the board meetings of her property company. So the fact of the matter is, we can't get her into debate. So I'm very pleased that we've got Lawrence Spiegel here in debate, and I think it's quite correct of him. And when he says, incidentally, that he's not an apologist for the Labour Party, and he's not here to apologise for them, well, may I suggest a wiser course next time is that he does come and apologise, because that's what really the working class requires. It requires one big apology for the time that has been wasted by the Labour Party in using up human political energies. And you see, my opponent, I'm very glad, he says our definition is too simple. He doesn't really know what socialism means. My goodness, I'm glad he's a social worker and not a bus driver. Because I'll tell you now, he says he doesn't know where he's going. He's talking about socialism. He's talking about socialism. And then the first thing he does, I mean, if I went out to a debate tomorrow and I had a debate on what is lung cancer and how can it be cured? I would expect to know what the disease was. What is influenza? How can we cure it? I'd expect to know what it was. He comes along to what is socialism and how can it be achieved? And he stands up and says, well, I don't know what it is. What can we expect? But then, of course, when he says that the Labour Party is a broad church, when in fact it's a shrinking church at the moment, but I'd say this. When you talk about the Labour Party being a party which has got committed anti-racists in it, of course it has. It's got dedicated, sincere, committed people who want to fight racism. Some of the best of them. But the trouble is, it's also got racists in it because it's a broad church. And the trouble is that whenever it's been in power, it's carried out those racist policies. And that's why the Commonwealth Immigrants Act was carried in 1968, because it was a racist policy in line with the needs of British capital. Of course it's got people in it who want peace. What party, apart from the Federation of Conservative Students, hasn't got people in it who want peace? But the trouble is, in fact they're going to get peace in the Federation of Conservative Students by stopping them from meeting. But the fact is, of course, you've got people in the Labour Party who want peace. You've got people in the monasteries over in Europe who want peace. The trouble is, you've also got a conference, democratically decided Labour decision, to support NATO. And NATO is one of the two major organisations which is committed to the mass slaughter of the working class. And if you're a member of an organisation that is committed to the mass slaughter of the working class who support the NATO, then that's no different from an organisation that supports any other of the most pernicious policies. Of course you've got people who opposed what my opponent calls the Malvinas War. But you've also got a fellow who they called an inveterate peacemaker called Michael Foot. And Michael Foot stood up in the House of Commons during the emergency debate, and he said to Mrs. Thatcher, if Mrs. Thatcher does not send the task force out into the South Atlantic, she will be showing the British people that she is not leading a responsible government. So Mrs. Thatcher responded and said, all right, Michael, as you suggested, the idea was on my mind anyway. I'll set the task force, and this is the trouble. But let me conclude by saying this, and I say it with the greatest of force that I can muster, and that is, one of the most important arguments my opponent puts, and I think it's the most compelling argument, it would be the only argument that would ever lead me to join the Labour Party, and fortunately it's an argument that would never lead me to join the Labour Party, and that is the argument of the lesser evil. Because when my opponent says, look, the worst of Neil Kinnock is better than the best of Margaret Thatcher, he's forgotten one thing. We haven't seen the worst of Neil Kinnock yet. We haven't seen it! But what he wants us to do is to give Neil Kinnock the opportunity, and then we will see it. And this is what we've got to guard against. This argument of the lesser evil, and that's why the Labour Party, incidentally, is called a broad church. The Labour Party is called a broad church because the people in it are religious. And when I say religious, I mean they adhere to a dogma. They adhere to a dogma, and that is why they almost seem physically offended when they hear the Labour Party attacked. They adhere to a dogma which says that you've got to carry on repeating these stale and worn-out policies because revolution is too much for the working class. And what we would say to the Labour Party is what old James Connolly once said, and that is that the great only appear great because we are on our knees. And in exactly the same way, of course capitalism looks like an insurmountable barrier to the achievement of socialism. But what we'd say is, take on capitalism, take the fight beyond the limits that the Labour Party has ever dreamed of going, and remember that when the workers are united on the basis of political knowledge, there is absolutely nothing that can defeat us in the victory for socialism.
Very much.